There are a couple of mics set up for any of you who have some questions, and I'm sure Professor Winter will be happy to entertain them.
It's a brief question. So how should we be teaching about the First World War now?
Well, I think one of the challenges, and this is a global challenge too, one of the challenges about teaching the Great War is to recognize it as linked in fundamental ways to the Second World War. I mean, the way that I've taught it for 40 years is as intimately related to a form of collective suicide that European societies went through between 1914 and 45. The world that exists after the Second World War is a world that's a conscious rejection of that which was created in 1914 and played out until 1945. So perhaps one way to do it is through the Second 30 Years' War of the 20th century, and to bring to students who know more about the Second World War. This is true in many parts of the world, that the Second World War is immediate and accessible. And one way to teach the First World War is to say we got to enlarge the Second World War, because without the First World War, it never would have happened. Hitler was a child of the First World War. He couldn't conceivably have gone anywhere without it. Lenin would never have been anyone other than a mad Russian revolutionary without the First World War. We can see a whole range of linkages that I think enable us to break, as it were, the screen memory, Freud would have called it, of the Second World War. That you occlude the first by the second. In my view, the best way to teach it is to accept the fact that the Second World War is in people's families' histories and in the narratives that we all bring, but that it wasn't, as it were, a conflict that came out of a blue sky. It was created by the First World War, and again, this is controversial, by the catastrophic peace that ended it, which is something I would not commemorate. There are other days that I think we need. As I said, the 4th of May is much better a date than the 28th of June 1919 to commemorate the end of the war.
Early in the war, after the German army had passed through Belgium and into France, they turned south instead of advancing toward Paris, thus setting up 4 years of trench warfare. Yeah. Why do you think they turned that way?
I think that the German army turned to the east of Paris rather than to the west of Paris, because the idea, the original plan, was impossible. In other words, the Schlieffen plan, which, by the way, everybody knew the Schlieffen plan. They had practiced it. They were all at each other's war games. Everyone knew what it was. But the Allied, later to be Allied troops and generals, believed that the Germans wouldn't be crazy enough to try it. And the reason is that it pushed the German army, which was extraordinary, but it pushed the German army to the limits of human endurance. 42 days. And, you know, it's a German army. It's not 43 days. It's 42 days. There's going to be, as it were, an enormous move of 1 million German troops from Aachen, near Cologne, where they were all staged, through Belgium, all the way through Belgium, and then an enormous arch in which, as Schlieffen said, the sleeve of the last German soldier on the right flank would brush the English Channel and then sweep up behind Paris and destroy the French to the west and south of Paris. That was what they were aiming. So what happened was this unbelievably, as it were, densely populated region presented obstacles. The first was the fort of Liège. They couldn't destroy it without using their very heavy guns, and they did it. It took longer than they thought. Then they believed there was civilian obstruction, which was not true. It came from the memory of 1870, where there was civilian obstruction. And the men who were junior soldiers in 1870 were senior commanders and said, shoot the lot. Any civilian who shoots without a uniform must be shot. And they shot 6,000 innocent Belgians on the basis of a false memory. So when they moved into France, and the purpose of the British Expeditionary Force of 100,000 was to take a bloody nose and literally get destroyed in order to slow them down. By the time they got north of Paris, there were two branches of the right wing of the German army, which got separated. Now, that's very easy to understand in terms of the confusion of war and the chaos of it. The German army's headquarters were in Luxembourg, and they depended upon telegraphy. That was the stupidest thing to do. Because what are soldiers going to do at the end of a day when they've been marching with a 60-pound pack on their back, under fire, in the heat of the summer, in this intensely populated area? What are they going to do? They're going to sit down and make dinner. And what are they going to use as firewood? The telegraph poles. It's perfectly normal to understand how the concept of control of battle, that you can understand what's going on and you can command it, is simply insane. So when they got to the north, as it were, to this point where there was a split, they suddenly said, we better send somebody down there. And he was a man nobody knows anything about. He's called Lieutenant Colonel Hench. And Lieutenant Colonel Hench got to the point and saw that there was close to a mile divide between the two branches of the right wing of the German invasion, and anybody who has the slightest understanding of military strategy will realize that's dangerous. That's dangerous because of a flanking movement, divide the two and destroy them. So what he did, he ordered the right flank to move towards the left, and that means moving to the east of Paris on the Marne and not to the west. So my answer to you is that the German army did it because the plan was completely impossible in the first place, and that as soon as it became clear that it was impossible, the commander, von Moltke, whose uncle was the victor of 1870, the commander had a nervous breakdown, realized it was all over. And from that moment on, the German army, through its genius of what they call the operatif, which is a way of turning orders into boots on the ground, were able to create a defensive, as it were, structure to cover their initial defeat. And because of their genius, they were able to wear down the French army and the British army and the Australians and the Canadians and everybody else for 4 years. They just couldn't do it forever. But 1914, I think the war was lost right then and there. And the reason was it was a war, the best form of which to play is not to play it at all. It was lost from the beginning. I'll go even further than that. The moment that the Schlieffen Plan started by invading Belgium, the Germans lost the war because they knew from diplomatic exchanges that the British would not accept a French defeat because that would put the German Navy on the English Channel. And the control of the English Channel is the control of British imports, and 75% of the British food came from abroad. So the British would not accept German control of the English Channel. So when they invaded Belgium, it was to get that control. And at that moment, Britain declared war and turned it into a war for the control of northwestern Europe. It was not for a scrap of paper, the way Bethmann Hollweg said. It was for a real conflict, for a real issue, and ultimately that control of northwestern Europe was what was finally decided in 1945. So I think the German army lost the war on the very first day of its breaking out. Yes?
I just have a question on how memory is passed on from generation to generation. Because the Great War is 100 years ago now. And I'm intrigued in my travels. I mean, in some parts of the world, we see young people showing up. For example, here we have Remembrance Day. I'm always struck by the number of young people and people of all generations. In some countries, they've been able to take the experience of the Great War and translate it down through the generations to say, we're not glorifying war or the cause. We're remembering these people. But yet in other countries, other cultures, a young person wouldn't be caught anywhere near a war memorial.
That's right.
It's something that's in the distant past. It's something that you don't go to. It's suspicious because you're seen as glorifying war or the cause. And especially in countries that were defeated, where the cause is nowhere near being noble. Or the portrayal of the history of the war is so national that even the neighbors can't come up with a common history of that war. It's still seen as national divisive. Do you have anything to say about kind of how memories are passed down to the younger generation, how young people can be brought into the kinds of commemoration that you're talking about in a way that's inclusive and not nationalistic or political or ultimately destructive and divisive?
Well, it's an important question. It's one to which the initial question, how do you commemorate those who die in war or how do you glorify or honor those who die in war without glorifying war? So that is the question. That seems to me the essential question of this commemorative season. And the answer is twofold. The first is the growth in the number of young people who are attending commemorative sites from all over the world is partly a growth of what I call pacifism. And by that, I don't mean a doctrinaire rejection of war, but a rejection of a war like 1914-18. That's the key issue. To be pacifist, in my sense of the term, is not to be on principle against war, just to be against that slaughter. Now, the reason why you have to say that is because of the justification of the war against Hitler. That's the reason why, again, bringing together the two world wars makes sense and teaching them in schools, as I have, is that the justification for war in 1939 seems to me to be clear, but the justification for war in 1914-18 is anything but clear. And in fact, the war that emerged was one that was bore no resemblance to the initial conflict. So the claim I want to make is that there are very large groups of young people, the Australians probably are most prominent among them, who have transformed commemoration into what might be described as a global peace effort. And it's really intriguing to see this. I've seen it in Europe as well, but I do believe that you're perfectly right, that there are different memory regimes, and one of them is in Eastern Europe. In Eastern Europe, they're beginning to commemorate the wars of liberation after 1918 in Poland, for instance. There's going to be a museum of the Great Patriotic War of 1918 to 21, which they won. They threw the Soviet army off their soil. The notion of 1914-18 as a disaster isn't there because the notion of 1914-18 isn't there. They never had a history of the First World War. They had a history of the Bolshevik Revolution in its place. When you turn further afield to the Middle East, or indeed China, where I've been recently, they have no sense of the First World War at all. So what I would claim is that there are different memory regimes in the world, and the one that exists in the West, in inverted commas, has now opened a possibility of using the First World War as an icon of everything that the European Union, whatever mess that it may be, it's certainly better than the story that I've just described. And it is that politics, the politics of a bloc in the world which basically has no army, and has no capacity to use force. Individual nations do, but the European Union doesn't. It has no force. Its force is entirely economic, insofar as it has it. So my claim is that the people are there. Young people are doing this without my having to tell them or anyone else plotting it. And that the reasons are that it's a certain kind of memory of catastrophe as the counterpoint, as it were, the null set, that which we have turned away from after 1945, that is driving it. And the more I see of it, the more I'm hopeful. There's a transmission of memory which is much more to do with the current world order and its miseries than necessarily to do with nationalism. I might add that's the reason why we made the Cambridge History of the First World War. You know, I'm the editor-in-chief, but I'm the head of I'm a concert master, and there are many wonderful musicians in that orchestra that produced it. But there's not a single chapter on a nation. It's entirely transnational. There's no chapter on Canada. There's no chapter on Germany. There is a chapter on North America. There is a chapter, indeed, on Africa, on Asia, on Latin America, the things that have never been done before in large histories of the war. So we have tried in the Historial and in other places to construct a transnational history of the worst war the world had seen to date. And maybe that's one way to teach it, that it's not possible to teach the Great War in national terms anymore. It's very, very difficult to understand the point of your series, the turning points, unless we see them in transnational terms.
Good evening. My question is, would you say that disillusionment with war was more of a post-war phenomenon, and that it was actually influenced more by the memory of the war than by actual experience?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I would be so bold as you are in distinguishing between memory and experience. I think every one of the experiences we have is mediated through memory. And I certainly know that several of the experiences that I'm sure I went through never happened, because my memory has transmuted them. And this is certainly true for soldiers. Everybody knows how this is so. But there are two separate issues here. The first is the turn against war that happened in the interwar years is something we've forgotten because Hitler made it impossible to sustain. But there's a brilliant French play by Jean Giraudoux called La guerre de Troie n'aura pas lieu. The Trojan War never took place. Won't take place. Imagine this for a translation into English. Of the Trojan War won't take place. It appears in English under Tiger at the Gates. Talk about memory and experience. But the important point about it is it's entirely pacifist, entirely a turn away from war. And Giraudoux was a French soldier at Gallipoli. The turn away from war that made George Bush and Tony Blair squirm a bit and be inventive with the truth, I think that happened in Vietnam. I think it had a direct outcome of the American humiliation in sequence after the French humiliation in Vietnam. And that was one that could not be really sustained. It was partly buoyed up by 9/11, but even that went. So that the polls that indicated that Obama could not get a vote through Congress to support a punitive raid on Syria for using sarin gas seems to me to indicate a delegitimation of war in political terms. Moral terms is something else, but it strikes me as something that we should really take note of. Yes.
So some people say that the slaughter of World War I was because of using old tactics with new weapons. Is that something that you agree with?
No, I wouldn't, because you see the new weapons were ultimately successful. The reason why the Allies won the war is that they finally got counter battery fire right. It was an artillery war, and of course it was artillery war well before that. Every time there was an advance, and the artillery laid down a barrage for the infantry to go forward, there were counter battery positions 10 miles away, 20 miles away, on the other side of a hill, which could immediately turn the field of advance into a killing field right away. And that's really what happened. It's not the machine guns that did it, although at the first moment of the Battle of the Somme, that's true. But the reason why the ideas of the generals of a breakthrough failed is that they didn't get counter battery operations right. It took the development of air power for that. Air power was an arm of the artillery. It didn't have an independent existence. And once air power and trigonometry and, you know, figuring out where the flashes were of artillery operated in such a way, in 1918, finally the Allies got their act together to suppress the counter-battery fire that had been so murderous. So this is, you know, artillery war is not new. What is new is the coordination of service arms in order to make it effective. And by then, and only by then, the old idea of a breakthrough was superseded by the idea of bite and hold. Literally, you move forward slowly and successfully, but not by breaking through the lines. So Napoleon died finally in 1918. The idea of a breakthrough battle was sustained until virtually the end, in the last 100 days of 1918. Finally, they got their act together. But it took time to learn how to do that. So old ideas, yes, breakthrough. That was a mistake. New weapons, I'm not so sure. It was the coordination of the weapons they had which made the difference. Yes.
Commemoration of war, I find that really, really sad that you commemorate killing people, doing whatever you have to do. I'm not talking you just to, but killing people in the name of peace is, I find, very, very strange. Because right now they say, oh, we're doing this for peaceful reasons. How can you say that killing people is peaceful?
I didn't say that.
No, I didn't say you said that. I'm saying that the governments say this.
Well, I'm trying to make a case, as I said, I thought it would be more daring than perhaps it was, that there's something happened to the politics of warfare to make it almost impossible to do in democratic countries. In other countries, of course, that's not another matter, in the Middle East and so on. But the concept of waging war has many of the ideas that you've just expressed in it among a broad section of the population. And if it is the case that commemorating the First World War is commemorating the end of that, goodbye to all that, that you've just described, then it's a moment, I think, to pause and take note of. If war ultimately turned into an illegitimate act because of 1914-18 and not because of the war against Hitler, then I'll celebrate it. I won't celebrate war, but I'll celebrate the turn away from it. And my claim was there's something of that kind that has come out of the commemorative movement that I call the memory boom of the 20th century. I'll put it this way. I'm still hesitant. I'm uncertain, but I'm hopeful that commemoration has a political consequence to it, which is to make war undoable.
I hope so.
Yes.
I followed with interest that the Second War is a child of the First, and you made reference to Lenin perhaps would have been nothing and so on and so forth. But I don't mean to be dismissive, but just to get to my point, the Second War was initiated by Hitler, and there are those who would say that Hitler would have never come to power or to the strength that he did had it not been the punitive provisions of the Treaty of Versailles. Can you offer a comment on that?
Yes, I can. I think the Treaty of Versailles was a disaster. I don't agree with some of the recent scholarship about it. It was something that rearranged the explosive material that had created 1914-18 and simply set it off in an even bigger bang in 1939. So the first thing is the idea that only Germany was to blame for the war was humiliating and unjust, and almost certainly untrue. Germany was at the heart of the war crisis of 1914, but there are multiple levels of responsibility in which all the major players have an element of responsibility attached to them. Sir Edward Grey, for example, the least responsible were the Brits. I don't think anyone says that the Brits planned the war. It's not true. But Edward Grey never said openly, loudly, clearly, in whatever diplomatic or political or journalistic way, the invasion of Belgium will be an act of war. He never said that. It was the truth. It was inevitable. Why? Because Britain and France had engaged in secret military negotiations over the Entente Cordiale, that in the event of war, Britain will send an expeditionary force to France. That was a secret agreement. And when the Prime Minister, Asquith, and Grey told the cabinet of the secret agreement and its codicils, the cabinet was shocked. The cabinet didn't know, much less Parliament. Nobody knew that Britain was committed to go to war for France in 1905. So the foreign secretary was one of the two people who knew the whole story. He never said it. He never stood up and said to the German ambassador, Lichnowsky, tell the Kaiser, tell anybody, tell everybody, the invasion of Belgium will be an act of war and the entire British Empire will be at war with Germany. He never did. So what he said later on, if only we had had a League of Nations, this is the words he used, where we could have brought this crisis, the whole thing would have been solved without war. So my claim is that the Versailles judgment, that Germany, Clause 231, is responsible for the war and only Germany is responsible for the war, is a great mistake and was condemned by political figures on all parts of the German spectrum. It wasn't just the Nazis, but it gave them enormous moral strength, as did the continuation of the Allied blockade after the armistice. The German population went hungry between November 1918 and June 1919 to stop rearmament. That's basically why the Allies did it. But that was clearly a war crime. It was waging war against civilians. There's no doubt about it that it was an attempt to give the bitterness of war back to the German people. It just so happened to be a war crime. And all those things created, as it were, what shall I call it, a cloud of false legitimacy for the Nazi movement to restore the honor of the German nation. Certainly Versailles was a devastating blow to the possibility of maintaining peace. I like none of it at all. And there are defenders of Versailles. Margaret Macmillan has written a very interesting book about this a few years ago, saying it did the best that anyone could do. I think it did the worst than anything that anyone could do.
Good evening. Do you think Turkey will ever accept responsibility for the Armenian genocide? Do you see that happening in the near future or ever?
That's a good one. I'll tell you a story very briefly. 3 years ago, I went to I went to Turkey to give a lecture, and I wanted to give it on the Armenian Genocide, but I was asked, please don't do it. So instead, what I did was to give a lecture entitled The Social Construction of Silence. And when I did that, student after student at the end of the lecture said that was the best lecture on the Armenian Genocide I ever heard. Because everybody knows what nobody says. It's one of those... You know, lawyers are trained in order to create words that create different meanings for the same things. They have to do it. I don't think there's any choice in the matter, that slowly but surely the Turkish regime will see that joining Europe is inevitable, and that the price they have to pay for that is to recognize that another regime in another century engaged in a crime, which, by the way, Ataturk saw as a crime at the time. The reason why they don't do it is because they believe that the crime has been used by the Western powers to literally divide Turkey, to try to threaten the territorial integrity of Turkey itself. This is the story of the birth of the Turkish nation. Well, they need another story. And as I say, I think there are people now working on it. My guess is that by 2018, they will find some formula which will be good enough to say that they recognize that what happened to the Armenian people under the fog of war was the destruction of the Armenian nation. They won't use the word genocide because they believe they're not Nazis. You know, there shouldn't be any equivalent to the Nazis. But they'll use a form of words that will enable them to go back to the negotiations that have to come in. The idea that Istanbul is not a European city is completely crazy. You know, it's like St. Petersburg not being a European city. There's no sense of that at all. They'll find it. I'm hopeful. Perhaps in my old age I'm getting to be a little benign. But my view of Turkey, I've been there a few times now, is that there are real movements. Yes, tensions, and yes, obstacles, but real movements.
Do you think that revelations that we've seen, like from people like Bradley Manning, the WikiLeaks, and Edward Snowden and all that, will have any effect towards exposing... I guess, the fraud of war or the fraud of justified war and further the cause of peace? Or do you think that people just become desensitized to that and turn away? Do you think those kind of things have any effect on the horror of war and what it actually is?
My guess is, and it's as good as yours and no better at all, is that the long-term shift that I described as a turn away from war, a delegitimation of war, that long-term shift has started for totally different reasons, embedded in the family histories of people, you know, who saw the 1914 conflict as a catastrophe. And then the war against Hitler in some way re-legitimated war after its delegitimation. It took the ending of the Cold War for us to go back to an idea that Europe must be defined in some other way. And my guess is that the ways in which the exposure of the normal diplomatic language of lying and bullying and so on has worked is on the surface, and that the fundamental issues of war and peace are now that police actions for short periods of time probably can be sustained in the court of public opinion, but war is no longer a legitimate way of doing business, and that is what 1918 was supposed to be. We've waited a century, and if that is indeed the outcome of the commemoration of the millennium, as it were, 1,000 years from now, it'll be too long. But if it's now, if it's in the next few years that we can suddenly recognize how deep a movement there has been away from war, then I think in a way the same position that you defined of seeing war as a senseless waste of human life, maybe that will become a position that most countries in our part of the world can accept.
I think that's a really good note to end the evening on. And I'd just like you to join me in thanking Jay Winter for what's been a wonderful presentation.